Hello and welcome to this special episode of the Pump Court Family Law Podcast. Today I'm joined by Helen Brander, a financial remedies specialist at Pump Court, who's going to be guiding us through the new financial remedies court protocol, which was produced in the wake of the Farquhar Committee's recommendations and represents a significant change to the way we do things at the financial remedies bar. So Helen, welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Hello. Hi, Tara. Lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you. Yes. So everyone has been focused on what the new protocol means. Can you just tell us a little bit about it and what it involves?
Yes. On the 11th of January this year, so a month prior to us recording this podcast, on the judiciary website was placed a note from Mr. Justice Mostyn attaching various documents and setting out the new financial remedies court protocol. And that has derived from a consultation following the report of the Farquhar Committee, as you've said, and then a revision of the previous good practice protocol, which has now been split into two major documents: the Financial Remedies Court Primary Principles document, which are the major principles of that court, and then the Financial Remedies Court Efficiency Statement, which deals with good practice in the Financial Remedies Court. It does not override the family procedure rules and the provisions therein, but there are potential cost consequences for non-compliance with a number of the points of good practice. And there has to be good reason then to derogate from the provisions of the efficiency statement. So it's really important that every financial remedy practitioner is aware and follows the contents of the efficiency statement and the good practice protocol.
So dealing with the efficiency statement, first of all, what does that document tell us?
Well, the efficiency statement deals with actually what happens once proceedings are underway. You need to look first of all at the primary principles document, which then sets out how and when, or how one goes about actually making a financial remedy application. It defines what financial remedy applications are in its appendices and requires the parties to complete an allocation, well, the applicant to complete an allocation questionnaire, again, as one of its appendices, when making an application. And that allocation questionnaire has to be completed following consultation with the respondent to the application for the purposes of completing that questionnaire. And that will then set out which level of judge the parties think they should go before and what the principles are. The same as the efficiency statement for the High Court.
High Court, yeah. So it's just making...
It's the same details, in effect, that one has from the efficiency statement in the High Court, the 2016 efficiency statement, but you're now looking at what is a formal allocation questionnaire, like one might see in the civil procedure provisions in the county court. We've now got them in the financial remedies court, setting out what requirements that particular case has and who should hear it and why.
And what are the requirements for that document to be filled in if you're, for instance, against a litigant in person?
It's still meant to be done in consultation with that litigant in person.
Okay.
And then you make your application to the court. If it's two litigants in person, it's I don't think, if I recall correctly, that that applies. It's something that is would be expected, or it might be sent out to them by the court, but it has to be dealt with, certainly if you're represented, or if you're representing someone.
And just in terms of the, sorry to interrupt, just in terms of the timing of that, when does that document need to be sent to the court?
That needs to be sent when you're making your application, so with right. Form A. And you can, at the same time or thereafter, agree directions as well to be made at the first appointment and use the accelerated first appointment procedure. It's also sets out in those primary principles that the court will at all stages encourage people to consider alternative dispute resolution as well. And that has to be set out as well in the allocation questionnaire. What's also made clear in that document is that if the parties do agree to go to an alternative dispute resolution arrangement, then the details have to be provided to the court about it, what exactly they're going to do, when, and the dates and so on. And they won't be given more time, more court time. So there won't be further listings of substantive hearings, save for a mention hearing, which may be vacated on by consent by the submission of a consent order, or otherwise you would then start up the procedure again if you haven't reached an agreement. But you don't, there's not an automatic listing then for substantive first appointments, FDRs and so on.
So quite a focus on ADR being important.
There is a focus
primary
all the way through on ADR to try and encourage people to agree outside of the Financial Remedies Court. But then, of course, the judge still retains jurisdiction to make sure that the orders agreed are appropriate for the parties. So that the court would have to approve the orders.
And so for solicitors wanting to get hold of a copy of the allocation questionnaire or the summary of the accelerated first appointment procedure, which is also exhibited, where did they get hold of those documents?
Those documents are attached as schedules to the primary principles statement, and one needs to look. In fact, it's only in PDF form so far as I can see at the moment. I anticipate they're going to be formally published in some other way on the judiciary website. Certainly they've published the other documents in Word and Excel form, so the efficiency statement one, ES1 and ES2, which we'll talk about later in more detail, but that's a composite case summary and a composite schedule of assets and income. They've been published so that they are more user-friendly, but at the moment these appear only to be PDF documents. But of course PDF documents can be converted to Word documents by extracting them from the PDF file and opening in Word.
Okay.
That's another lecture.
What one that I'm sure we'd look forward to, but for, but for today's really? For today's purposes,
yes.
When we're talking about financial remedies, is that limited to your sort of bog standard financial remedies, or does this also incorporate Schedule One applications?
It does incorporate Schedule One, and in fact, the again, the primary principles document sets out the definition of financial remedies at the first schedule of that document. And that includes Children Act Schedule 1 proceedings, Part 3 proceedings under the Matrimonial Family Procedure Proceedings Act 1984, all applications for enforcement of financial remedy orders. And it is anticipated that there could be an extension to deal with claims under the inheritance provision for Family Independence Act 1975 and freestanding claims of a family nature under Talata as well. But that requires changes to primary legislation. So it's not happening yet, but the existing powers will deal with third party property in issues that arise within financial remedy cases. So somebody else is asserting an interest in a property that's in dispute in the proceedings. So there is scope for extension there, yes.
And what about the accelerated procedure?
The accelerated procedure involves accelerating the first appointment in particular. So agreeing the directions prior to the first appointment and sending them into the court once there's been the proper disclosure that's taken place, and then asking the court to approve those documents on paper. We've become much more familiar with that over the course of certainly the early days of the pandemic. Yeah. When that was instituted with vigour, gusto, but it seems to have slipped back a bit. But that is only done where the parties agree that that is appropriate.
Oh, yeah.
But that is, but it's done secondary to the anticipation that there will still be personally attended first appointment hearings.
Yeah.
Either remotely or in person. Looks like we're going back mostly to in person. Because the court recognises the value of the parties hearing their arguments advanced and judicial reaction to those arguments at the first appointment. And also to be reminded of the level of costs that they have already incurred and are likely to. But if the benefits of if directions can be agreed in advance and attendance has little purpose and the benefits of personal attendance are outweighed by the costs, then the accelerated procedure can and should be used.
And so if actually we now we've issued the application, we're well within proceedings and we're expecting the first appointment in due course, what does the efficiency statement say and how has that procedure been changed?
The efficiency statement really deserves detailed reading. It is a long and detailed document, and it sets out, as a supplement to part 9 of the FPR, really, exactly what's expected at each stage in each hearing. So it makes clear that first appointments, where they're attended, are going to be listed for 45 minutes, 60 minutes in complex cases. If you need a different amount of time, you've got to argue for that in your questionnaire. It sets out that the first appointment may be used as an FDR, of course, as before, but that you need to tell the court first so that they can specifically list that in for a longer hearing. And FDRs now will be generally listed for a 90-minute hearing. That will be the standard rather than the previous hour or so.
And which makes so much sense.
Absolutely. And in the morning. In the morning, the efficiency statement says with an anticipated 10 a.m. start.
Yeah.
So that is so that you've got the full day. And it also makes clear that the parties and representatives are expected to be available for the whole day. Sometimes we do have difficulty where somebody just hasn't anticipated that.
Yeah.
Or it hasn't been explained to them.
Yeah.
But that's absolutely set out in black and white.
And if you are looking to convert that first appointment into an FDR, I mean, one of the obvious stumbling blocks always is timings. If you've got an FDA listed at 3 o'clock, even if they could extend the time to the hour or whatever it might be, there's a practical reality that actually that's not going to help anyone because there's not going to be enough time to negotiate. Do you think there's going to be more flexibility now with moving the times of the hearing to make it possible to convert into an FDR, or are we going to see the same problems as before in that regard?
I sincerely hope that there's going to be the flexibility, because everybody in the Financial Remedies Court should have this protocol and the efficiency statement in mind. So everybody should be front loading their work and anticipating that actually this is a simple case. They just need an indication on this point. Can we have an FDR as early as possible and aim for that? And in fact, it's all aimed at that, really, because even in advance of the first appointment now, 14 days before the first appointment, the parties have to file jointly obtained market appraisals of the former matrimonial homes or otherwise competing ones where they can't agree, and then they have to explain why it was impossible to obtain the joint evidence. They have to use their best endeavours to provide the property particulars. So this is before first appointment, three property particulars for them and the other, and brief indicative material of borrowing capacity. So for example, a mortgage calculation from a bank's website. It should be jointly obtained, so they should both be aware of what the other is saying, and then send that into the court together with any questionnaires, which should be no longer than four pages of A4, 12-point font, 1.5 line spacing. So no more long questionnaires with irrelevance. No. It's got to concentrate on the matters in issue. And the idea is that if you've got all that information available, you'll be able to see whether you're ready for FDR. The court will be able to see whether you're ready for FDR, and you may be given the timeframe with the expectation that there will be an FDR.
And can I just ask you about the language used in the efficiency statement? Because there's a difference, isn't there, before first appointment and FDR. The word should is used for providing those documents before first appointment, and the word must if it's an FDR. So what does that lead you to believe in terms of the requirements on the parties? Is it a case at a first appointment that you should be doing it, but if you don't, there aren't going to be any consequences?
Yes, I mean, should, but that's the expectation. And if you don't, it's likely that there will be criticism. There's the issue of cost consequences hangs heavy over all of this efficiency statement and protocol. And of course, the courts can make, the Financial Remedies Court can make such cost order as it thinks fit, subject to Rule 28.3. But we have to be aware that we're meant to be being efficient. This is good practice, and we should be complying with good practice. It's good for our clients, it's good for the court, and it's good for us as practitioners to make sure we're doing it in accordance with this efficiency statement. It is efficient. So the expectation is to provide that. And in fact, I know from my own anecdotal experience that solicitors are doing this now.
Yeah. But what I'm finding, Helen, is that actually when it comes to particularly the mortgage raising capacity, where an FDR people would have plumped or insisted on evidence from a mortgage broker going through all the variables, what I've noticed people are already doing, particularly if it helps their case, is to just do a kind of online bank which serves their case. And so actually the value of that, it's not as valuable if you're able to put forward evidence that is self-serving on that.
No, but the idea is though that it's jointly obtained. The provision at paragraph 10 B2 is for the parties to file with the court jointly obtained brief indicative material as their respective borrowing capacities. So they should be doing it in conjunction with one another with the same tools. And if one party says, well, that's obviously not right, here's the same information presented differently, then that will be something they'll be arguing about at the first appointment / FDR.
Yeah, it's the jointness of it.
And again, it's the usefulness of having the attended first appointment is that the parties will see the judge's reaction to that information.
Mm.
It's not pushing it further down the line.
Mm.
But he or she will say to the parties, this is the information I've got at the moment. You're probably not going to get very far with this, or that needs to be stronger if you're going to make that argument, that kind of thing.
But does that serve to sort of unnecessarily increase costs? Because if everyone's agreed, we're not ready to convert the FDA into an FDR, but you've got to provide all this evidence anyway. And if it's jointly obtained, you've got to be communicating with the other side. There are costs associated with that. And if that's actually not going to be used in any meaningful way at the first appointment, is there any point?
I hope that it will be used in a meaningful way. And I'm sure that's the thinking behind this, is that this information is really easy to find. It's not how it used to be. You have to go into estate agents and obtain these documents, then produce them, go and speak to a mortgage broker. It's all available at the click of a button. We can all do it for each other, and we're always comparing each other's arguments on this.
Yeah.
So it really doesn't add to the cost, I don't think, and it doesn't, and it will, even if they reduce the number of first appointments that are ineffective as FDR by 50%, they increase it by 50%.
Yeah.
That's got to be of a benefit to the court users and to the court itself.
And as you say, it's that encouragement for parties to actually front load their cases, so that we're not kind of waiting until just before FDR for actually someone to say what their case is.
And if you've got the all that information in place, but you still can't agree, or it's not going to be an effective FDR and first appointment, you've seen the judicial reaction, you've heard the judicial reaction, you might then choose to engage in a private FDR or mediation thereafter. And that's the point at which you might get the more detailed information.
Yes.
But you've already had an informal judicial indication to push you along.
Well, because part of all of this as well is that the judge hearing the first appointment is going to be the person hearing your final hearing. That's the aim, isn't it? So
there's two ways. Well, there's meant to be a specific, there's meant to be judicial continuity.
Yeah.
But the efficiency statement makes clear that there are two ways of doing it. So a judge might say, well, I'm going to hear this up to FDR.
Yeah.
Obviously not afterwards. Or I'm going to do the first appointment and any final hearing, but I'm not going to do the FDR.
Because I'm wondering whether if you get a judge sort of weighing down heavily at the first appointment against perhaps a direction that, you know, you get the actuary involved or whatever it might be, something that you think is going to help your case, and a judge is firmly against you at the first appointment, I'm wondering if this is going to lead to basically judge shopping for a final hearing, that you'll say, well, actually, I think this judge wasn't really with me, maybe I'll try and get this case to arbitration or something like that, so I know I will get a different tribunal.
Yes, there's that, or otherwise people might be encouraged to have that judge for FDR so that they know they don't have to have them after that
for the final hearing. It's going to be a bit more tactical.
There's that prospect, and of course that already happens anyway.
And so moving on to the FDR, let's say we've had our first appointment, we've got our directions, what are the changes that we need to be aware of leading up to FDR?
Leading up to FDR, as you've already pointed out, all those documents that you referred to become far more detailed and are become must. You've got to provide that information. You can choose, as I've said, private FDR. If you do so, you have to set out in advance who you, the date of your private FDR, who you're going to use. And you have to stick to that.
Yeah.
That's what the court expects, that there's not going to be any shifting around and won't be given another court FDR after a private FDR. So it goes then to a mention hearing and then you move on from there. So it must take place. Prior to both the first appointment and the FDR, there have to be the submission of the new documents ES1 and ES2. So prior to the first appointment, the applicant has to file this composite case summary, ES1. Really a really neutral document, but a composite case summary, one day before the first appointment, and also the composite schedule of assets and income, which literally just sets out figures. There aren't any specific calculations. There's no slant on it. It's a completely neutral document.
And it's also, it's right, isn't it, Ellen? Sorry to interrupt. It's right, isn't it, that with those documents, you don't actually have to reach any agreement with the other side as to either the case summary or issues, because you each get your box, don't you, to fill in.
It's all in columns. It's all in columns. So there's applicant and respondent. This is what the applicant says. This is what the respondent says. These are the issues as far as the applicant is concerned. These are the issues as far as the respondent is concerned. These are the directions you're going to seek, no more than 80 words, or other issues, no more than 80 words.
So they should be easy to fill in. They should be easy to complete and get done. Yeah.
One side fills it in, sends it to the other side fills it in. That's how it should work. And because it has to be done by shuttling between the parties in advance of those hearings, it should be done by the solicitors, or otherwise by the litigants themselves, prior to the hearing. And then where counsel is instructed, counsel would expect to see those documents already completed. They can then prepare their own documents to go to support it or to go with it, but you wouldn't expect them to send in a competing schedule of assets and income.
No.
You're going to prepare a schedule of assets and income for yourself, then you might want to take boxes from that and insert it into your position statement to show net effect and so on.
Well, I was going to say, I've already found that I do end up doing my own schedule of assets and liabilities anyway, because I need it for my net effects tables. So I end up doubling up if I'm asked to do both, or rather if I'm asked to do the ES2, because I'll be doing it anyway. And I think actually from other practitioners, I've noticed they prepare their own schedules anyway.
Yeah, but it's not what the court wants to see.
No.
Clearly we have to argue net effect, and that is the place to extract your little section of your schedule from your Excel spreadsheet and stick it into your Word document or whichever program you're using to explain your net effect. So that has to be a day before for first appointment. And for FDRs, that has to be no fewer than 7 days before the financial dispute resolution appointment. So those documents have to be updated. There also has to be a composite chronology in neutral terms, which is often a problem, just setting out the key dates of the party's relationship and the litigation, and where any undisputed events are clearly denoted. And the efficiency statement sets out clearly that the parties have to collaborate to prepare those documents, and it's unacceptable to be presented at an FDR or a final hearing with competing chronologies and asset schedules. So then for the FDR, the primary principles say 90 minutes. the efficiency statement says 1 to 1.5 hours.
Mm.
So again, it's not clear, but the presumption is it's going to be 90 minutes.
90 minutes.
In the course of the morning, say the says the efficiency statement, primary principles say from 10 o'clock, but parties have to be available for the whole day. If you have a private FDR, as I've said, the court has to agree to it. And they will do so where you provide details of the private FDR evaluator, you dispense with an in-court FDR, and once it's fixed, you have to stick to it. It can only be adjourned by agreement or pursuant to an order of the court, then you only get the mention afterwards. The anticipation is, if you're going for a private FDR, you will say as much at the first appointment. And so the efficiency statement sets out if you haven't agreed the details of the private FDR evaluator, but you're intending to go to a private FDR, then you need to bring details of that evaluator or your proposed evaluators to the first appointment, and the court will choose, just as they would for a single joint expert. That's paragraph 15 of the efficiency statement.
I mean, that's very tricky, isn't it? Because the whole point of a private FDR is that it's got to be the party's joint choice.
Quite. So it's overriding that. It's saying either you agree or we're going to choose it for you. If you agree you're going to have a private FDR and you can't agree on the identity, bring along your people and we'll choose. And then you risk, of course, exposing the identity of your private FDR judge to the biases of the court judge, which may be something that you're wanting to avoid.
And also, avoid. With experts, you come armed with your CVs and timescales. I mean, are they going to come armed with the private FDR judge's CV and... costs
you have to bring appointment details and fees details and not necessarily their CVs by but of course a number of the people who do run private FDRs are well known to the family
and what about position statements and the new expectations there? I mean, they've got to be lodged now by 11 o'clock on the day before, and they've got to have certain time limit page limits.
Well, I'm just trying to find that position statements. Right, the court, the efficiency statement deals with this from paragraph 24 onwards. And they have specific page limits for each hearing. So, and it includes any attached schedules.
Yes.
So if you're attaching anything from your disclosure, it includes it. So first appointment, 6 pages. Interim hearing, that's not the first appointment, 8 pages. For the FDR, it's 12 pages, but that excludes agreed documents. But includes any other attached schedules. So excludes agreed documents is the composite documents, the chronology, the ES1, the ES2. And for the final hearing, it's 12 pages, again, excluding agreed documents, but including any other attached schedules. A4 paper, not less than 12-point font, 1.5 line spacing. It has to define and confine the areas of controversy, however you choose to pronounce it. You have to have numbered paragraphs. It has to be cross-referenced to any documents in the bundle. You can't quote from case law or from other documents. And it has to be self-contained. And the court should read the previous position statement prepared for such a hearing. Can't have any of that. And then it also has to include specific matters from paragraph 31 of the efficiency statement, which sets out what the parties have done to negotiate openly. You have to negotiate openly and reasonably. You're also meant to set out what details, what efforts the parties have done to negotiate responsibly. And there are potential cost consequences for not negotiating openly. We know that.
Yeah.
But they will, parties are to be warned about that at the hearings. And then for each hearing, obviously, there has to be the Form H, some or H1.
Yeah.
And so, that is sometimes honoured in the breach.
So, Helen, you mentioned Form H, and that leads me to think about costs.
Yes.
Are there any cost implications or any fallout from failures by solicitors or barristers to comply with the primary principles or efficiency statement?
Certainly, there it's made explicitly clear at paragraph 29 that of the efficiency statement that if advocates fail without reasonable excuse to comply at the final hearing with provision of the composite documents ES1, ES2, and the chronology, or their length and content of position statements are wrong, or the time for filing the position statement is wrong, then they potentially risk an order being made disallowing a proportion of their fees pursuant to the civil procedure rules 44.11, subparagraph 1, subparagraph B, and or section 56(1)(6) of the Senior Courts Act. So there is a warning also in the CPR about that, and in the efficiency statement for cases proceeding in the High Court or at High Court judgment from 2016. So yeah, there is that risk that if we don't do it properly, we risk the court saying you're not going to have your fees paid, or this proportion is not allowable. But surely that's on a costs assessment. And that's saying, well, the other side shouldn't be paying those costs. That's a decision in the CPR.
So must be.
It may be that the court will deprecate an amount of cost being paid by a client to an advocate for that. But to what extent the court can then say, no, you're not going to have your fee paid, I'm not at all clear. Because surely that's a matter of contract.
Yeah, exactly.
But yes, and it specifies advocates, but of course it may not be the person who's responsible for preparing these documents, or some of them at least, the solicitors. Are not necessarily going to be the advocates at that final hearing. But as far as paragraph 24 and 26 in relation to the position statement is concerned, that must apply to all hearings. It's not simply the final hearing.
Well, Helen, that has been a whistle-stop tour through the new protocol, and I myself have found that incredibly helpful. I'm particularly worried about the cost implications for advocates, and I'll make sure I do everything on time. But I'm sure our listeners will really appreciate that, because everyone's muddling through what this very weighty new protocol means for us as practitioners. So thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure. My only advice to everybody is read it again, and then read it for a third time. And make sure you have it handy when you're prepping your cases.
Sage advice. I'm sure everyone will take heed. Thank you, Helen.
Thanks.